proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Our quote for the day from Aristotle: the best political community is formed by citizens of the middle class. Well, increasingly in America, the middle class can't even get health care. The Democrats in Congress, in the House and Senate, are trying to push forward an expansion of the S-CHIP program, the program that would expand children's health insurance in the United States. Republicans pushing back, saying, no way, ain't going to happen. We don't want this to happen. Diana DeGette, the Democrat of Colorado, leading proponent of the House bill, just came out and said, for a long time, I was mystified why Republicans would oppose expansion of the children's health insurance program to kids who are eligible and not enrolled. Now I realize they're trying to deny us a political victory. They want to be able to say that Democrats can't get anything done. Is this about politics or is it about ideology? Mike Davis is here with us. He's a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, a think tank heavily funded by conservative foundations and corporations. And he's also an economist at SMU's Cox School of Business. The website for the National Center for Policy Analysis, ncpa.org, and SMU, of course, Southern Methodist University. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So is the Republican opposition to this S-CHIP program the result of an ideological difference? Is it kowtowing to the tobacco industry lobbyists? Or is it an attempt by Republicans to prevent Democrats from simply doing anything that's going to make the American public happy? So come 2008, they can say, you guys didn't do anything.
I don't know. Maybe yes to all of the above. That there's clearly an ideological component to this. The Republicans do have an interest in, I think everyone is on board to the extent of recognizing that the healthcare system we have is a disaster. And your introduction, the middle class is feeling squeezed by the rising cost of healthcare, is true. But the real disaster is with these lower income groups that have very little income. So, and by the way, I'm not here speaking on behalf of anybody but myself. I'm not carrying water for the Republicans by any sense. Okay. But I do think everybody acknowledges there's a big problem here. There's a debate on the best way to fix it, and that's the ideological component of it.
But so in your opinion, what's the best way to fix it?
Yeah.
I mean, if the Republicans are going to say no to this, to raising the tobacco tax to pay for this, then, you know, what do you do?
There's two separate questions. Do you ask me if I like the S-CHIP? I have some problems with it, but I also know that we got to get these kids better health care. If you ask me if I like the tobacco tax as a solution to paying for S-CHIP, my answer is no. The tobacco tax is already quite high. The average tax is about 70 cents a pack, and we're talking about significant increases in tobacco.
Yeah, taking it up to about a buck.
Yeah. Then that's the average. I mean, you go to some places, you go to Rhode Island, for instance, it's right now about $2.50 a pack. There's lots of reasons not to like tobacco tax as a revenue source.
But tobacco is, you know, nicotine, particularly crack nicotine, which is what is in most cigarettes. They use ammonia to alkalize it, so it's free-based rather than the old-fashioned, you know, the pre-1945 nicotine, which was not free-based, was not alkalized. This stuff is five times more addictive than heroin. Why not raise the price of it to discourage use of it?
Well, you know, and there you go. If you think that's an appropriate role for government, if you think, and you have just made a very elegant case there, if you think that this is a drug and that people shouldn't use this drug because it's bad for them, then go after it. I would say taxes are one way of doing that. But if you really don't want people to smoke, why not just step up to the plate and make tobacco an illegal product? Or regulate the
because I think that anything that can grow should not be criminalized.
Okay.
I do have a problem with adding ammonia to tobacco. Well, I think that's converting it into that's like taking opium and converting it into heroin. I got a problem.
God love you, Tom. I'm not you know more about the chemistry of tobacco than I do, but I'm not doubting you for a minute. If you're right, That's a bad thing, and then if that's what we want to stop, let's stop that. But what's really happening with the S-chip thing, and really with all of these tobacco taxes, is the politicians want the revenue. And this is true for the S-chip program, but it's also true, maybe even more true, when you see what happens in the trenches in the state legislature. Every time they need revenue, they try and find the group that is politically least powerful and try and impose a tax on them.
Right, this is because everybody's afraid of going back to the old idea that taxation is the price you pay for entrance into the civil society. In the 1950s and 60s and 70s, 33% of the total tax revenue that came into the federal government came from corporate taxes, and now it's 7%. I mean, the entire tax load has been shifted off corporations and off the extremely wealthy. Warren Buffett points out last year he paid 17%.
Okay.
His secretary paid 31%.
Yep,
it's been shifted off corporations and the wealthy onto the backs of the middle class and working people. But you know, you made a point, Mike, and feel free to rebut that if you want, but you made a point that you think that these kids should be getting health care. That seems to be inconsistent with the position that Republicans and conservatives generally take, which is that it's not the role of government to provide health care for anybody, much less, you know, even including poor children.
Absolutely. Well, government's going to be involved in one sense or another. Right now, if you want to talk about the health care system, it's certainly the case that government policies, for instance, not allowing tax deductions for private insurance, have made it more difficult for poor children to get health care. But if we want to talk about the tax burden, you know, again, you can cite statistics any way you want to. The corporate income tax is largely a tax on the middle class. Corporations, it's the oldest cliche in the world, but it is absolutely true. Corporations collect taxes. They don't pay taxes.
No, it's absolute nonsense. Corporations are separate entities, and when corporate taxes go up, the price of products does not necessarily go up. Just like when the cost of manufacturing goes up, the price of products doesn't go up.
There's all kinds of evidence to indicate that you're wrong.
Now, come on. David Ricardo laid this out
well
in On Profits
well
in 1816.
And it's common sense, Tom. There should be some things that we can agree about.
Are you suggesting, Mike, that when Phil Knight figured out that he could make Nikes cheaper in country B than in country A, that instead of increasing his profits and making more billions, that he dropped the price of Nikes?
I don't buy Nikes myself. I buy the competitors' products because it's a competitive market for shoes. And Phil is going to charge what he can for a pair of Nikes.
Exactly.
Like
the marketplace determines the price of goods, not the amount of taxation on the corporation. We have lost Mike. Mike, so much for calling in on a cell phone. Well, Mike, good shot, and appreciate your being with us if you're still able to hear us. But anyhow, Republican leaders of the House and Senate on yesterday, attacked proposals. They call for a major expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program to be financed with higher tobacco taxes. And Representative John Boehner of Ohio says Republicans will fight these proposals. Excuse me, Boehner. Republicans will fight these proposals. And in an unexpected turn of events, this is Robert Pear writing the New York Times today, the top two Republicans in the Senate, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and Trent Lott of Mississippi, said they oppose a bipartisan bill that the Senate Finance Committee approved last week, and they would offer an alternative on the Senate floor. I do think that this is obstructionist behavior on their part. I think it's dangerous and destructive, frankly, both to working people and to kids in this country and just, you know, in general to the whole concept of health care. There's another issue, perhaps a larger issue here going on that I think has to do with the future of this country. Today from the front page, and which in a way kind of piggybacks on the back of this, and that is that are we looking at an imminent economic collapse, a crash? Countrywide Financial, this is from today's Wall Street Journal, the nation's largest mortgage lender, said yesterday that more borrowers with good credit were falling behind on their loans and that the housing market might not begin recovering until 2009 because of a decline in house prices that goes beyond anything experienced in decades. And what's really interesting about this, and Joshua Rosner offering an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal about it, these are screaming headlines in the Financial Times today and financial newsletters and websites all around the world, is this collapse of the subprime market. So far, only about 2% of this market of low, what are sometimes referred to as low value or high risk loans given to people who don't have absolutely sterling credit ratings, Only about 2% of this market has been hit so far. The Bear Stearns hedge funds, you know, there's been a couple of funds that have crashed. And the consensus is that this is the leading edge, not the trailing edge. This is going to make it so much harder for the middle class and working poor in the United States to get even housing in addition to health care. It's just an entire mess. 16 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. My kids don't read. And my kids don't write. I'm stuck in a traffic jam every night. The crime rate's up, but that's all right. 'Cause I got low taxes. Low taxes like they have in Mississippi. Low taxes, that's what I live for. Low taxes. You bet your sweet bippy, I hear those low taxes singing my song.
Ah, the wonders of low taxes. Mike Davis is back with us. He's a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis and an economist at SMU's Cox School of Business, ncpa.org, the website. Mike, we got cut off. Maybe Alberto Gonzalez doesn't like us discussing economics here.
No, I think it's a great right-wing conspiracy. They were afraid I was going to start agreeing with you, and they couldn't do that.
Well, it's amazing, actually, how many long-time, really serious conservatives we had on last Thursday, for example, the former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, calling for the impeachment of George Bush.
Really?
I mean, it's amazing to me how many conservatives are coming around to the fact that this administration is just a train wreck. But the larger issue that we were discussing when your phone croaked or ours did or whatever happened, is the economy here to serve the people or are the people here to serve the economy? You know, why do we have economies? And you were trying to assert also that a corporation isn't a separate entity, that a corporation is somehow...
It's just a compact among a group of people, so that money's got to come from somewhere.
It comes out of the pockets of the investors.
Pardon me?
So I would assert that when corporations pay their share of taxes, because corporations do use the commons, and speaking as somebody who owns a corporation himself and has for the better part of 30 years, when I employ people, I'm making use of the fact that they had a public education. That's the commons. I'm using the commons of the court system to enforce contracts. I'm using the commons of the Treasury Department to make sure that my currency is stable. The commons of the regulatory system for our banks and insurance companies, and on and on and on.
Okay.
When my corporation uses the commons, it should pay part of the cost of those commons.
In the form of sales taxes, use taxes, property taxes. No one's saying that corporations should get a free ride, although if you look at a lot of the so-called economic development programs that are happening at the state and local level, that is happening. And if you ask me, that is a much bigger scandal than some, you know, reduction in corporate tax income tax rates. I absolutely believe that corporations should be paying property taxes. They should be paying sales and use taxes. But what I don't like is these corporate income taxes, which get spread to people we have no idea who they are. You say it's the investors. You say that costs aren't passed on to consumers. You know, we can argue about that point, and I'll win. But the fact...
No, you won't.
Come on.
You've read David Ricardo, haven't you? You know, you're an economist.
Look. The problem I have with corporate taxes is actually we will have that argument and neither of us will win. Nobody knows what happens when corporations are taxed. We know that somebody's got to write the check and that somebody's going to be an investor, it's going to be an employee, or it's going to be a customer. Those are the only...
Well, there are a couple of things that we know. One thing that we know is that in the period of the golden age of the American middle class, corporations were paying 33% of all the taxes in the United States, and they were doing very well, thank you very much. There was a lot of growth in the United States in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and now the corporations are paying 7% of the tax. We have corporations saying, screw you to America. You got Halliburton going over to become, you know, part of the Dubai and...
Don't stop the clock in 1980, Tom. We had an awful lot of growth in 1990 and in the early 2000s when we had reductions in all kinds of taxes.
Right. My point being that it doesn't matter.
Taxes don't matter. I'm sorry. Did I miss something?
Yeah, no, that's my point. Whether they're paying 33% or whether they're paying like they were in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and early 80s, or whether they're paying 7% like they are now, they still grow.
How about 50%? If taxes don't matter, why don't we put a 90% tax rate on corporations? If you
think
taxes don't matter, have the courage of your convictions and go for it.
Well, actually, we've done that. We've done, you know, windfall profits taxes that get up into the 90% range in some areas.
And you think that's a good idea?
I'm frankly ambivalent about that. I think that there is a reasonable range for taxation, and whatever that reasonable range for taxation is for us individuals should be the range for corporations. I think it's crazy that you and I as working people are paying 30-35% income tax and a third of the corporation, a third of the top corporations in this country pay no income taxes, and the majority of them are paying, you know, less, you know, an average of 7%.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Well, what's wrong is not knowing who pays taxes. The reason politicians like corporate income taxes is because they disguise who is actually writing the check. It's got to come from some individual. You say corporations are people, but that's a complete legal fiction. They are groups of people. Somebody is writing the check for those corporate taxes, and you can't tell me who it is.
Yes, I can. When corporations pay more in taxes, they reduce their dividends. They, you know, they reduce their profits. It comes out of profit.
I hate to pass it along, but
they can only pass it along if the market will bear it.
I hate to pull rank on you, and I don't know that you're going to accept it anyhow. But let me put on my economist cape and just say that there is a great deal of research, a great deal of literature, which disagrees with that point. We just don't know who pays those corporate taxes, and that's the problem.
So let's just go back to the taxes we had 30 years ago. Worked just fine.
Are you going to join NCPA? You're starting to talk like them now.
Yeah, okay. Mike Davis, Mike, senior fellow at NCPA.org. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Hey, this has been one of the best interviews I've ever done. Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Sing a song of taxes, working class cancer sore, be in Boston Harbor, Revolutionary War, of giving to the rich and taking from the poor. Sing a song of taxes, let's even up the score. Sing a
34
song
minutes
of
past
taxes.
The hour. Just a quick summary here. John Conyers has just released a 52-page report, quoting from the report, that for the first time alleges specific ways that several administration officials may have broken the law during the multiple firings of U.S. attorneys. The committee today is going to vote on contempt charges for former White House counsel Harriet Myers and Chief of Staff Josh Bolton. We'll see how that shakes out. The commander of Fort Lewis in Washington State, Lieutenant General Charles Jacoby, is expected to decide today whether to go through with plans to hold memorial services for U.S. troops killed in Iraq once a month instead of after each death. Military families and others, but particularly the military families at Fort Lewis, have protested this mass funeral memorial service proposal. A federal judge in California ruled yesterday against the federal government's attempt, this is from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org, against the attempt to stop investigations in five states of George Bush's domestic spying program. The judge ruled that neither the Supremacy Clause nor the Foreign Affairs Power of the government prevented a state from asking about phone records. This is interesting. And Arlen Specter used a very, very interesting phrase in his discussion with and about Gonzo. Time magazine, quoting quoting Arlen Specter, as saying, the maximum penalty for being caught lying to Congress is 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000 per count. Specter Riley noted to reporters during a break that there is, quote, a jail in the Capitol complex, end quote. Now, what that, in my opinion, I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. What that is referencing is this concept of inherent contempt. Inherent contempt, the concept that I believe Randy Rhodes was first talking about. John Dean started talking about it. Keith Olbermann was picked it up, and now members of Congress are talking about it. It hasn't been used since the 1930s, but it's where the House of Representatives, or the Senate for that matter, can simply say, okay, we're an independent branch of government. We have our own police department. It's called the Capitol Police. And you, sir, Mr. Bolton, or you, ma'am, Ms. Myers, you are in contempt, and so we are arresting you under our own authorities to do so, and we are putting you in our jail in the basement of the Capitol building. And there's a jail cell down there that hasn't been used since the 1930s. So when Arlen Specter says there is a jail in the Capitol complex, I may be drawing more of an inference than is justified, but I think not. So that, plus, you know, all the economic news of the day, the one point I wanted to make, and then we'll pick up your phone calls here, is the failure, the absolute screaming failure of privatization, the failure of the Securities and Exchange Commission to oversee agencies like Fitch, Moody, and Standard & Poor's, who rate companies, rate bonds, rate, you know, the debt, basically, in this case. And in today's Wall Street Journal, Joshua Rosner writing, Stopping the Subprime Crisis. First of all, he points out, he said, yet for 5 months, it's been clear that rising delinquencies and foreclosures, he said, we've seen this train wreck coming, basically. He says, yet it took Moody's Investor Service, Fitch Ratings, and Standard & Poor's, the three leading agencies, until this month to react to a looming financial crisis, which involves more than $1.2 trillion in subprime mortgages. Now, why, you may ask, did it take them so long to react? And he lays it out. He says, Fitch and Moody's claim they are not obligated to verify information or to, quote, conduct any investigation or review or take any other action to obtain any information that the issuer has not otherwise provided. As Fitch points out in its code of conduct, he writes, this disclaimer flies in the face of reason and seems to violate the obligations of Fitch, Moody's, and S&P as investment advisors under the 1940 Investment Advisors Act. So basically what he's saying is, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the government agency that oversees all this stuff, needs to be doing its job and hasn't been. And as a consequence of that, we've got this mountain of debt, very shaky debt, that is on the edge of falling over. And when it falls over, it could take the entire country with it and much of the world. We could be looking at another Great Depression. And there's a lot of people very, very concerned about this. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. On this subprime crisis, I got a couple of things on this. You know, one, it was artificial. This whole housing boom was artificial. It was caused by the Fed lowering the interest rates, but we won't get into the Fed's aspect.
In part, it was also arguably caused by the SEC saying that they're not going to actively regulate banks and deciding who gets mortgages.
Correct, and that brings up where I was thinking. This is strikingly similar to the S&L crisis of the 80s.
Yes,
if you remember, in which the Bush boys had their own S&Ls and profited nicely from that.
Oh, Jeb Bush made out like a bandit on that thing with Silverado,
so did Neil.
Savings and Loan.
So did Neil. Yeah. But yeah. What I wanted to say about this.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it wasn't Jeb. It was Neil. You're right. I got the name wrong. But anyway,
Jeb,
as you were saying.
Jeb had one too. But what I wanted to say about this, I think there's so many groups that benefit from this, and I think there's an aspect of social engineering to it as well. In that what's going to happen here is this thing is going to go through the snake. This bump's going to go through the snake. Who knows what's going to end up with the losses? But I can almost guarantee it'll be the taxpayers and the pension funds.
Sure.
At the end. But it'll also put a lot of baby boomers upside down in their mortgages. And these are baby boomers that were expecting to retire off their home, off the asset of their home, and there has been a lot of controversy, but there's a lot of talk about a labor shortage when the baby boomers leave the workforce in the next coming years. And it starts next year, 2008, and they goes on to about 2018. And at that point, they'd typically be selling homes, moving to smaller ones, moving out of country maybe, and leaving the workforce. I think that has been successfully short-circuited. And you know, these were key people in the labor force, not people turning a wrench. These were rainmakers, people of, you know, top salespeople, et cetera, you know, valuable people to corporations. And I think that's been short-circuited. I think they're going to be upside down in mortgages. They can't sell the house for what it's they owe on the mortgage. And with the new bankruptcy laws, they're going to be locked into this thing. They're going to be working a lot longer than they ever anticipated. Greenspan was warning about this labor shortage for 5 years before he left. He would slyly talk about it in front of Congress. And I think this was well planned. I think there's social engineering. I think there's a lot of profit being made. And I think there was a lot of people that were ambivalent to the politics of the day because their house price was going up so much every day. They didn't care.
And there's a huge element here of screw the middle class, too. This last weekend, we were back in Michigan. My father died a year ago last week. And my mom has Alzheimer's. She's living with one of my brothers, and my parents had collected. I mean, they owned their home, bought it and it was paid off long before Dad died, and they collected antiques. They collected. Dad had 20,000 books. He had all these glass plates. Mom collected buttons and postcards, and they were just like into all this stuff. The market for this stuff, because my brothers and I are now, having to dispose of a lot of it to try to, provide for mom's old age. The market for this stuff has absolutely collapsed. And the reason it's collapsed is because people of my parents' generation who collected it are dying, and it's all coming out in these estate sales and things. I mean, we're talking about, 10 cents on the dollar in many cases. It's absolutely startling. It partly that and partly eBay. eBay, consolidated the market. And that, we're seeing the same thing with housing. I mean, these, housing, collectibles, the kind of stuff that basically the middle class was investing in or had been investing in for much of the last 20, 30 years, all that stuff has fallen off the edge of the earth. On the other hand, people like the Bush family, invest in top-of-the-line stocks or who are investing in government debt and things like that, they're doing just fine, thank you very much. And they're only paying 15% income tax on it.
You read my mind on the eBay thing about the collectibles, but you're right. Exactly the same thing is going to happen with housing. These houses are going to start coming onto the market, and it's going to drive down the price. The debt's going to be...
It already is.
They're just not going to be able to move. You won't be able to relocate for a new job. You won't be able to do anything. You're going to be stuck. We saw this in Southern California here. People that were upside down in home loans for 10 years, and it was absolutely miserable. They couldn't do anything because they won't take that loss.
Right. Yeah. And, or they can't in a lot of cases. Good point, Dave. Thank you very much. Jeff in Fort Benning, Georgia. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. I just had a comment about that guy that was on that was saying that he can't pinpoint exactly who is paying taxes when a corporation gets taxed. It would seem to me that, as a private person, I can own property and I can hold property and I can be taxed on that property and, even employees, all that kind of stuff. But a company can hold property. Like, a company can own land. If that land increases and that value increases and the assets go up, it's a taxation on that asset. Now, somebody would probably say, well, the shareholders get the benefits of that either from selling it through capital gains or through dividends, and they have to pay the tax. But my point is that I mean, I could go on over a corporation and just let my property sit in there and gain value, and the the commons that are being used to make that property. There's no, I'm not really paying for that in the end. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. Now, the point is that, corporations have historically been referred to as artificial persons at law because they have to have some legal status so they can own property, pay taxes, sue and be sued, things like that. And you and I are referred to as natural persons. And we are entities, economic entities, and economic entities are paying taxes. I just don't, I don't buy it that it's all just people paying taxes eventually all the way through. It's economic entities. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
It doesn't matter where just a mile off the road. Take it in, take it with you when you go.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Whose economy is it? You know, when you get all the way down to the bottom of it, whose economy is it? Matthew in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Matthew.
How you doing? I tuned in and you were talking about the economy and higher taxes, and it just got me thinking about a lot of times people argue about how universal health care in this country would have make us pay higher taxes and how that would poorly affect the economy. And it's always kind of in the abstract how it's talked about. And my brother drowned southwest of Eugene on July 7th. And 4 weeks earlier, he was in the psych ward at the hospital there. And it was the first time he was ever displaying psychotic behavior. And my friends who work in the field of the mental health field have talked to me many times about how the insurance companies here put pressure on the doctors to get people out quicker when they should stay longer so they could find out what's going on with the person.
Yeah.
So basically...
this goes back to Reagan, in fact, you know, of emptying the mental hospitals in the 1980s.
Right, and so I really feel like I lost my best friend due to greed of these, you know, insurance companies, the UnitedHealth CEOs, you know, and that there's these real world effects that take place. And, you know, countries like Switzerland and Sweden, if my brother was living there, probably right now would be alive, where they're paying higher taxes and their economy is very good. And, they have a higher quality of life as far as I'm concerned. So I really don't see, the fear and the fear based arguments. And, you know, when these things kind of get played out in the real world, you know, people die. And, you know, it really does affect us all. So that's what I wanted to say.
Well said, Matthew. Thank you very much. And your story does demonstrate, you know, how quality of life and taxation and the commons and government. I mean, why do we have government? It's to provide a baseline. Both, frankly, we used to believe back in the 30s, and Matthew, thank you for the call. We used to believe back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s that government provided, as with regard to the economy, both a floor, you know, your basics like Social Security, a floor through which you cannot fall, and a ceiling above which you cannot rise, so that we wouldn't end up with oligarchy, so we wouldn't end up with a few hundred families who have so much wealth that they can manipulate the government itself. And Reagan took away, chopped out a big chunk of that floor, and also took away the ceiling. And nobody's been talking about the ceiling since the 1980s. And I think it's a conversation we very much need to have, frankly. Denny in Wenatchee, Washington?
Yes. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Denny.
You know, I really got tickled with your guest. By the way, I enjoyed that conversation. But, boy, I'll tell you, when I was in college and in speech class, I'd have loved to have been able to use that premise that I'm always right when I say that I don't know. When he told you that he didn't know who pays corporate taxes, but he knew you were wrong, I found that pretty ironic. And I wish that we had a corporate tax rate that was about 50% and then would graduate down by how many Americans you hire, how high you pay them, and how high the benefit level is, and work down from that 50% level. And I
that's
think
a brilliant
that's
suggestion.
The best thing that would ever happen to this country.
That's a brilliant suggestion, Denny. It, just like if we want people to own houses, we give them an exemption on their income taxes to own the house. If we want corporations to employ Americans and keep their jobs and industry here, we should give them tax breaks for doing that. And those that don't, those who choose not to, or those who choose to go, you know, to reincorporate, like Kellogg Brown and Root reincorporating in the Cayman Islands so they don't have to pay any U.S. taxes, you know, just say, sorry, that loophole is no longer available to you guys. Denny, brilliant. Thank you. Eddie in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Eddie.
How are you?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I want to talk to you about the taxation on cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
But please listen all the way through if you could. In Texas, as of January 1st of 2007, they raised the tax of cigarettes $1. And so now it's $5 for a pack of cigarettes. And so most people are going across the border to Oklahoma, to where Oklahoma did raise taxes, but only by 40 cents. It's cheaper to go there and stock up and then come back. And the ones that do smoke, you admitted yourself that, you know, it's hard, you know, that you equalize it with being on crack or heroin.
It's five, nicotine is five times more addictive than heroin. Yeah.
If you've seen a person come off of that, that's very hard.
Oh, I used to smoke. I smoked for almost 10 years. I know how hard it is to quit.
So you're asking people to, well, now it has the additives in it. But they are, if you're asking people to go cold turkey, you just can't do it. So
no, but there's a lot of documentation. There have been a lot of studies out there that show that, particularly among the poor and the working poor, that as the cost of tobacco goes up, the usage of tobacco goes down, and that's a desirable thing. It's a desirable social outcome.
If you try to buy the sensations like patches and stuff, they're expensive.
But I'm telling you, as a former nicotine addict myself, it's an addiction that you can kick. It is an addiction you can kick, and there are millions of people in the United States who have kicked that addiction.
When did you kick it?
I kicked it when I was 23 years old. Why?
Okay, they didn't have the additives in it back then.
Actually, I think that they did. I think that the additives started in the 50s, and I started smoking in the 60s, and I quit in the 70s. But the point is that you can quit. People are still quitting. I'm sorry. It's just, yes, it's an addictive drug. And we need to do things to discourage its use. I mean, this is real simple. And if you can fund children's health insurance programs, I think it's, frankly, a lousy way to fund children's health insurance programs, but the conservatives have made everybody afraid of any other kind of taxes. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
For students to notice, I now call
Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, the Judiciary Committee Chairman. Let me begin by saying that today the committee will consider, well, here in his own words,
call up the report regarding Harriet Myers and Joshua Bolton for purposes of consideration. And I asked the clerk to read the report.
The bottom line, the House Judiciary Committee has voted to hold Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers in contempt of Congress. This now goes to the floor, and the entire House of Representatives will have to vote on it, and that will presumably happen after the August recess. So we'll see how this shakes out. But that's the breaking news of the moment I'm going to share with you. Congressman Jim McDermott is on the line with us. He represents the 7th Congressional District of Washington State. The website, house.gov/McDermott, M-C-D-E-R-M-O-T-T. And back in 2002, in the fall of 2002, I flew out to Seattle. I was living in Vermont at the time. And with my old friend Paul Loeb, we went down to a church in town in Seattle. I forget the name of the church. And Congressman McDermott and Scott Ritter were speaking about Congressman McDermott had just come back from Iraq, and we're speaking about the dangers of invading Iraq and the lack of weapons of mass destruction. Congressman Jim McDermott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's good to see you again.
Great to have you with us, sir. You were one of the very first. In fact, they derisively called you Baghdad Jim because of that trip that you made, fact-finding trip. You were one of the very first who was speaking what now, in retrospect, we know to be the absolute truth of the situation.
Well, you know, Tom, there's some times when you don't want to be right. I think as I look back on it, I was told things in those early days by people from Iraq when I was over there that clearly were the absolute truth. I could hardly believe what I was hearing, but it really has been an awful 3 or 4 years for me to watch this thing unfold in front of us.
Yeah, because it's unfolding essentially exactly the way you predicted it would. You have the Seattle Times did a marvelous profile on you a week or so ago, and I learned things about you that I didn't know, and I've been a fan of yours for years. That you have they say you've become a conduit for dissident voices from the Middle East that the White House doesn't want heard in the United States. That you have members of your staff who speak Arabic, that you monitor a number of Middle Eastern newspapers, from Haaretz in Israel to the Daily Star in Beirut to Al-Quds and El Arabiya, and Al-Dawa, the mouthpiece of Muqtada al-Sadr. You've become quite an expert in the Middle East. What's your take on, first of all, what's currently going on in Iraq?
Well, I think from all the sources that I'm in contact with, and I have a group who send me things regularly from what's going on in the street, just sort of their own talk about it, what they know about it, what they're talking and hearing their friends say about it, plus what's in the press. And my view is that we simply aren't being told the truth. The resistance, and I have to make a definition of resistance versus al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda are people coming in from the outside. They are Muslim fundamentalists, largely Wahhabists, some from Saudi Arabia. The resistance are nationalist Iraqis, both Sunni and Shia and Kurd, who want the Americans out. And this resistance decided, they told me that about almost 2 years ago, that the troops on the ground were going to get in real trouble, that they were hoping that they could bring us to our knees by taking out a number of people day after day after day after day, and they've done it. I mean, it's awful to see how well they've executed what they intended to do. And all they want is us to go away. They say, if you go away, if you announce when you're going away, it will stop. That's hard to believe.
In a way, this is very similar to what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan. And yet, when the Soviets left, there was this organization, al-Qaeda, which we had been funding to fight the Soviets, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who cut a deal with the Taliban to say, you know, we'll operate inside your country. That's the boogeyman that the right is throwing out now, and they were doing it really aggressively. If we get out of the way, then this is going to become al-Qaeda central. What are your sources on the ground telling you about that?
Well, they're saying, you simply don't understand. We know who these people are, and they're useful at the moment because they're creating problems for the Americans. But as soon as the Americans decide they're going to leave, we will throw them out. We don't want them here. We were never a secular country. We don't want to become a secular country. We want the freedom.
You mean a religious country, don't you?
I'm sorry?
You mean a religious country, that
yes,
they always were a secular country.
Yes, they always were secular. They don't want to become religious. Yes, I'm getting excited here. But they're really saying that we will take care of them. You don't have to worry about that. Certainly there will be people probably killed in all of it. I mean, it's not going to be, but you're having that right now. So it's not as though if we stay, nothing bad is going to happen. I mean, we're already seeing awful things happen. And I think that the thing that we have to understand is that the Iraqis want to live in peace. And they will do it as soon as they can get us out of there. As long as we want to keep bases and as long as we want to have the oil law pass and control the oil, their national treasure as they see it, we are going to have resistance.
And this is one of the things that I think most Americans don't understand is this oil law that was one of the benchmarks that both the president and, you know, I heard Nancy Pelosi saying, you know, this is one of the benchmarks we want to see passed, this oil law. Many Democrats are saying that they want this thing passed. Tell us about the oil law.
Well, the oil law is basically a way for the Americans, the four big oil companies of the world, Shell, and BP and Texaco
Exxon Mobil.
Yes, for them to get control of the oil. Now, they originally wrote the bill that they would have control of the oil. They wouldn't own the ground. They wouldn't own the wells or anything, but they would all the oil coming out would be theirs, and they would take 70% of the profit and give the rest back to Iraq. I mean, it was a very bad deal for the Iraqis. It's precisely why the countries were nationalized by people like Saddam Hussein and by Mossadegh over in Iran. The reason we threw out Mossadegh in Iran in 54 was he nationalized and said, we're going to take the Iranian oil for the Iranian people. And what we did was we moved in, knocked them out, put up the Shah, and for 27 years we had really free run of the oil in Iran. Well, the same thing was being set up here. And they said, you know, we're not new on the block here. We've seen this before, and we're not going to let it happen. And so we're just going to have to fight you. That's all there is to it.
Now, the Iraqi government has, you know, at one point, I understand that they had said that they were going to pass this oil law. Now they're pushing back on it. The Iraqi government seems to be fracturing. Is this the primary fault line?
Well, it is the fault line. It is when I was talking to people yesterday, they said, well, the thing that we're not going to let happen is for this oil law to pass, because if it passes, we won't have anything. We will have lost the war. We will have wound up being controlled by the Americans, and we're simply not going to let that happen to us. And so I think the battle between now and whenever we finally admit that we've failed in this area is going to be over whether they're going to control the oil or we're going to control it.
Now, we have just about a minute here before we have to take a break, but we'll continue our conversation after the break. We're talking with Congressman Jim McDermott, who is arguably one of the leading experts on the Middle East and Iraq in particular, in the U.S. House of Representatives, really, really knows his stuff on this issue. And Congressman, there were a whole lot of other changes to Iraqi law made by L. Paul Bremer, changing the going to a flat 15% income tax, banning unions, doing away with national industries. To what extent did the Iraqis want to roll those things back?
Not at all. This was basically a coup by the United States government to bring in Paul Bremer and wipe out any functioning government and start from the ground up with the neocon and the conservative right-wing agenda almost word for word. I mean, anti-union, anti-environment, making the maximum profit, having no social safety net, all these things were, I mean, that's...
And they thought it was going to produce a paradise. They thought that it would produce such an extraordinary, wonderful thing that they didn't even need a plan B after the invasion.
Yeah, they were so sure it was going to work. But what they didn't do was do what I did and go over to Iraq and walk around the streets and talk to the Iraqis. When you did that, you knew this was a pipe dream.
Yeah, amen. We're talking with Congressman Jim McDermott. We'll be right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, you believe in magic, like the magic that we can turn this country around and get it on the right track again? I do. I really believe it's possible, and I think that it's people like Jim McDermott who are making it happen. 21 minutes after the hour, we're talking with Congressman Jim McDermott. And after the bottom of the hour, if you have specific questions for the congressman, give us a call at 866-303-2270, and he'll take a few calls here. Congressman McDermott, are you the only member of Congress who has Arabic translators on his staff and who regularly reads all the press and talks with people in the Middle East?
I don't know anybody else who does Tom, I've had someone in my office now since 2001. I've had several Egyptians and an Iraqian, a Moroccan, I've also had a Algerian. I've had somebody always here, either as a Fulbright scholar or as an American public, Political Science Association scholar. And I use them that way. I mean, I look for somebody every year because I just believe that you have to listen to what the other side is saying. If you don't pay attention, I learned it in medicine that if you don't listen to the patient, you won't know what's wrong with them. Because William Osler, who was the father of American medicine, said, "Listen to the patient. He's telling you what's the matter with him." And I think too often politicians don't listen to what the other side is saying. So that's why I spend a lot of time reading and trying to figure out what they're up to.
Yeah, we should point out to our listeners, you're also a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, an MD.
Yep.
And given that, and perhaps you can do a little diagnosis here, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, and not her specifically, but she's emblematic of this. She just came back from Iraq a few weeks ago, and yesterday gave a talk. She's from Minnesota, back in Minnesota, where she said that she says, "I turned to my colleague," she says, while she was there, what was it like being in Iraq and in the green zone? She says, "It's absolutely huge. I turned to my colleagues and said, there's a commonality with the Mall of America." The Mall of America? I mean, how? And she's like, you know, yes, we need to escalate even more and blah. She wasn't even allowed to stay overnight. She never left the green zone. She never talked to any Iraqis. How do these folks go over there and get these deluded notions and come back as members of Congress and share them with people? I don't get it.
Well, you see, I think one...
You've been over there a bunch of times, right?
Well, I've actually only been there twice. I went over 1 month after the Gulf War in 91, and I saw all the devastation when George Bush the first went through there and backed out. And I saw what we'd done to Baghdad. We bombed the pumping stations for the sewer system and the water system and the telephone system. We destroyed the infrastructure of the country. Then we slapped on sanctions for 10 years. And I went back a second time just before this war went, because the church people who wanted me to go said, you know, go over there and find out what's going on. Well, I mean, I said, I know already, but I went anyway and talked to people over there, and the effect of 10 years of sanctions had made the people very angry and upset because thousands of children died. And so I think if you go and you have some freedom. Now, these people who go now, as you say, they're not going and seeing anything because they are totally managed in their trip. I've been in government long enough to know, and I've been in hospitals and places like that. So I know when I go into a place what I'm really being shown. And it was very clear to me that they were not showing these people, these members of Congress, what was going on over there. They just simply don't let them. They stay in Amman overnight, and they fly them up in the daytime, and they walk around in a flak suit inside the green zone, and then they put them back in the plane and fly them back down to Amman, and they say, "I've been to Iraq." Well, I'm sorry, but you haven't been to Iraq. That'd be like saying you'd been to Los Angeles by going to Beverly Hills and saying, "Well, now I've been to Los Angeles. I know all about Los Angeles." People would laugh at you.
Or even perhaps more appropriately, it's like somebody from outside the United States coming to Disney World and walking around and then flying back home and saying, "I've been to the United States."
Yeah, that perhaps is a better analogy, because it really catches the unrealness of what's going on over there. I mean, it's stunning what we in the United States have allowed to happen, and in our own name. I mean, now that's the thing that's troublesome, is realizing that people are dying on a daily basis in our name, and most of the people back home have no idea what we've put our kids into.
So when is Congress? What should Congress do about this? And I'm sorry, we have to take a break in about 15 seconds here, but we'll pick up the conversation on the other side. But.
Okay. Well, all I would say is the Congress has got to keep pressing the president. He doesn't want to give in. He will not do it easily.
Yeah. Okay. And the question I want to ask you when we come back on the other side is, what about Dennis Kucinich's suggestion that Congress simply say, okay, that's it, no more money, and you've got your $90 million, use it to wind the thing down. But I'll get your take on that on the other side of this, and then we'll take some calls for Congressman Jim McDermott. 27 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
That's right. It's one of my favorite songs from back home. Home on the Range. A home where no liberals roam and the folks all think the same way, where each house has a gun, a big caliber one, and strangers are told, make my day. Home, home on the range, where the beer and the cantaloupe lay, where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or so that it's one I can say.
Yes, the good old range. 34 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Jim McDermott. In my opinion, one of the real experts, one of the guys who really understands the situation on the ground in Iraq and in the Middle East in general. Congressman, you hosted just a month or so ago the president of the Electric Utility Workers Union in Iraq, Mashemia Mohsen Hussein. A number of people who have not been able to even get into the United States. You've organized teleconferences so that other members of Congress can meet with them and talk with them. The question, and then we'll pick up a few phone calls here. How do we extricate ourselves from this mess?
Well, I think we can take one of any 10 pieces of legislation that have been dropped in around here and say we're leaving in 6 months and begin the process, process of preparing to leave, and that will, I mean, it has to be done in an orderly way. We don't want to do it off the roof of the green zone. I think it ought to be done so people don't get hurt. And I think that if we let the Iraqis know that's true, I think there is a good chance that we can get out of there without having serious problems. The problem at this point is that our government is unwilling to admit that we have to do that. I think they still believe that if they stay and just hope a little longer, why, maybe it'll work. But it simply isn't going to work. And I think it's a process that has to start soon.
To a certain extent, though, for us to withdraw, there's going to be a huge power vacuum. Well, tell me if I'm right on this. This is my take on it, is that there will be a huge power vacuum because the indigenous government, the Iraqi government that we helped set up, is now perceived by the majority of Iraqis as basically American toadies. They don't have authority. And so, you know, what do we do? We bring in the Arab League? Bring in, you know, what? How do we take care of that?
Well, I think that basically the Iraqis will begin to pull it together for themselves. They care about what happens to their country. And yes, there is undoubtedly going to be some violence. I mean, my goodness, look at what's gone on so far. So there's no way to construct something where there won't be some loss. But I believe that the end result will be that they will settle this by sitting down and having a peace conference of some sort. We can't have a peace conference called by the United States because we are not viewed as even-handed.
And yeah, we're not the honest broker.
We're not the honest broker, and that is our biggest problem at the moment. We are considered to be in it for oil and for what's good for Americans, and that's all. And from their point of view, they can't see how that there's any way they're going to be better off with us calling a peace conference. They see that we'll just try and direct what the result is, and that they'll wind up in as bad a shape as they are now. So I think we have to let it happen. It'll be the Arab League probably, or the Saudis, or the Egyptians. There are a number of countries that have still got good relationships with both parties, and I think can be enlisted and will be enlisted to put together a peace conference.
But the Arab League is dominated by Sunni countries. The Saudis and the Jordanians are Sunni. The Shia won't push back on that?
The Shia certainly think that they're going to have a big role to play in Iraq, and they will have to have a feeling that they're going to get that this isn't a rigged deal. I mean, everybody coming to the table is going to have concerns because of the way we have sort of deconstructed their politics. But I think that to assume that they won't come because they think that, you know, there might be some people there who want more than they want is not an accurate reflection of what I've heard from the Iraqis that I've talked to. They've all said, yes, it will be messy, but it will happen because we want peace. We love our children. We don't want to kill everybody. And it's just a matter of us sitting down and dividing things up as we have done for centuries in the desert.
Yeah, this literally is the cradle of civilization. The very first city-state, Ur and Uruk, were in northern Iraq. You know, Gilgamesh, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the oldest known written record is
for Abraham,
northern Iraq.
The father of Judaism and Christianity and Muslim,
right,
Islam came from.
Right, the whole thing started there. Jeffrey in Kentucky, you're on the air with Congressman Jim McDermott.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
How you doing?
Pretty good. I was over in Iraq in 2004, uh-huh. And my interpreter, now granted he could be blowing smoke up my butt, I don't know, but my interpreter translated for me as a squad leader on the ground. An imam came up to me and said, hey, we thank you for what you did, and we appreciate what you're trying to do, but you need to leave. And I asked him, I was like, well, why are you saying that? And he's like, because we do not feel that we need an occupying army to rebuild. We've done it millennium before, and we can do it millennium after. And we want to build our country the way we want to build it, is basically what he said. And us over there enforcing doctrines and policies that they don't agree with is just causing not only civil unrest and strife, but it's also making us look like, you know, we're the, not liberating army, but we're the imperial stormtroopers going over there and stomping through the Middle East. And
I would say, you know, your experience is exactly what mine was. I heard people tell me that, people told me that the day after the election, I went over to Amman in Jordan, and I talked to Iraqis. There are now several million refugees down in Iraq, or in Amman and Jordan. And I said to them, you know, what do you think of this? And they said, you just got to get out. We're grateful that you helped us get rid of him, but you've stayed too long. You've kind of overstayed your welcome. And I think that Americans really have not come to grips with understanding that. And, you know, your experience on the ground is, in my view, the experience of anybody who goes and listens to the Iraqis.
Jeffrey, thank you very much for the call. Liz in Norman, Oklahoma. You're live with Senator or Congressman Jim McDermott.
Hi, my name is Liz.
Hi, Liz.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Congressman McDermott. You've provided me with a couple of interesting segues here, Gilgamesh, and people taking responsibility for their own lives. I'm a PhD folklorist. This is my only credential. I was never hired to be a congressman or a senator for the U.S. Senate. If I were aware of Scott Ritter's testimony in 2001, and I was aware of the UNICAL hearings in front of the Senate in 2000 from 1998, and I was aware of PNAC. Why wasn't my Congress? When I assume that people have a credential that they have been given by the American people, my assumption is not only that they are at least of marginal intelligence, but that they are willing to undertake the business of the people. Where was the research? Your staff did it. You took the initiative to learn, to understand what's going on. I work with freshman college students trying to convey to them some sense of what's going on in the world around them. As freshman college students, as 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, they can be forgiven on some level for not having done the research. How am I supposed to, every single day I wake up going, if I knew this, why didn't my government know these things?
That's a great question, Liz.
Can you offer me some explanation aside from just sheer callousness or indolence on the part of my elected government to explain to me why this is a continuous surprise?
Well, I think that, first of all, nobody really realized how much Mr. Bush was intent on invading Iraq from the very start. Many of us were worried about the resolution that we authorized, giving him some ability to prosecute the war, but we had no idea that he was intending to go as far as he did. Now, that's the first thing. But the second thing is we have an addiction to oil, and we simply as a country are willing to do almost anything to keep our addiction going. I mean, it truly is like the addiction that you have in any kind of situation where people are unable to control their impulses and they continue to use a drug. We are putting ourselves and have put ourselves continually in this position much because we were unwilling to admit that we were going to have to change the way we were living. And that has led us down a very, very ugly path that I think that's why people simply were willing to hang on and figure, well, maybe this will work and we can get away with this and it won't be so bad. And I don't think anybody at the beginning could see, many people could not see the end. They only were worried about our oil supplies and, you know, things like that. And for that reason, they simply ignored what was going on in front of their face.
Yeah, it's awful. We need a national 12-step program here. Congressman Jim McDermott, representing the 7th Congressional District of Washington State, House.gov/McDermott, McDermott. Congressman McDermott, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom, anytime.
It's an honor talking to you, sir. You're doing great work there in the United States Congress, and I'm so glad that you're representing so many of us.
Thank you.
45 minutes past the hour, Talk Radio News up next, and then back to your calls and more of the Tom Hartman program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
I'm a dream a thousand dreams. Been haunted by a million screams. But I can hear the marching feet.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Bob in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the program. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Regarding this oil problem, this oil law, the American people there has been disinformation from the media and members of Congress. For example, the oil law or production sharing agreements originated in the United States State Department. Now, what many
These PSAs, I mean, this is a model that has been used around the world for the better part of 50 years.
Yeah, but it hasn't been used. An example is not being used in Saudi Arabia. It's not being used in Kuwait. It's only
actually, it was in Saudi Arabia before. I mean, that's what Aramco was based on.
Absolutely. And they changed it. But what a lot of people do not realize. In Iraq right now, you have 80 oil fields. Only 17 of these oil fields are in production. Now, these 17 oil fields are the only oil fields that would be under the control of the Iraqi National Oil Company. The rest of the 63 other oil fields would be under foreign control. And all newly developed oil fields would be developed exclusively for foreign companies, which they would be able to repatriate 100% of their profits.
This is the amazing thing. You go back to Larry Klayman, judicialwatch.org.
Right.
Larry Klayman, the guy who found out about Paula Jones and basically brought the whole Clinton presidency, you know, that all those problems. conservative guy. He's the one who sued Cheney. And in his lawsuit of Cheney, he got the documents from, and you can find them over at the website at judicialwatch.org. He got the documents from Cheney's Energy Task Force in 2001, where, you know, in April of 2001, where they were dividing up the Iraqi oil fields and naming which oil companies in which countries they were going to sell which oil fields to.
Right. And you have, for example, what they would also have. They would change the, they have a tax rate of 40% that would have, they would go down to a 15% flat tax rate. But one of the most important things is they would be locked, the foreign oil company, they would lock them into contracts for 25 to 40 years.
Right.
Which Iraq would be locked into, no matter which government is into play.
Now, which is about the lifetime of those oil fields.
Right. And the reason for this surge, the reason for this surge is so that they will be able to get the Iraqi, whatever Iraqi government in place so that these these production sharing agreements come. The reason why your sons and daughters are dying right now is for that reason. The reason why you're going to have people who are sitting in wheelchairs right now and the only damn thing they can do is blink. It's because of these production sharing agreements, okay? What these people are doing reminds me of what Smedley Butler said in 1931 regarding that he was a racketeer for capitalism. And what these people are doing is unconscionable.
Yeah, well said, Bob. Bob, thank you very much. Very well said. And tragic. Bill in Oakland, California. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, okay. I got a question.
Sure.
What are the differences between Shia and Sunni? I think Kurds are a different nationality, but are there different doctrines, tribal feuds? Why are they different?
That's a good question. I think probably the easiest way for most Americans to understand it is that the difference between the Shia and the Sunni is sort of like the difference between Catholics and Protestants. One branch of Islam, I don't remember which is which, so I'm not gonna, you know, one of them traces their lineage back to Muhammad, to the bloodline of Muhammad, to his nephew and his children and grandchildren. The other traces their lineage back to the leading student of Muhammad. And so it's, you know, like the Catholic Church claims that they trace their lineage back to Peter, and the Protestant churches, by and large, are following Paul, who wasn't, you know, one of the original disciples. It's kind of, and that's a really lousy thumbnail sketch of Christianity, but you get it. Some Protestants will say Catholics aren't Christians. So the Catholic Church has been debating for years and years whether Protestants are Christians. The same thing with the Shia and the Sunni. They're both Muslims. It's just two different lineages, basically, of Islam, and then you've got the Iranians, who are not Arabs. They are ethnically, racially, they call themselves Persians, and they, you know, this is an empire that's existed for you know, centuries and unassailed, and they happen to be Shia, but they're also racially separate from all of the other Arabs in the Middle East, and they've always kept themselves, you know, they have this kind of notion that they're looking down their nose at the Arabs because they're Persians. They're Aryans, Indo-Europeans. And then you got the Kurds, who are another ethnic minority, a tribal distinct tribal group. And I believe that the Kurds are Sunnis, but I may be wrong. I don't know. But for the Kurds, the Kurdish national perspective is more important. Actually, I think some of the Kurds are even Christians. But in any case, the big problem with the Kurds now is Turkey, because Turkey has seized part of what used to be Kurdistan. I mean, they were given to them after World War One, and Turkey is now launching raids into northern Iraq, into the Kurdish regions, because they're afraid of an autonomous Kurdish state taking on part of Turkey, because, you know, they think there's oil there or whatnot. I mean, there's all these. It's just a mess. But, you know, that's the bottom line. Does that make sense, Bill?
Yeah, I think so. It seems like Turkey would welcome the Kurds because they're Kurds.
Yeah, except that they've got a bunch of Kurds in Turkey who have been basically waging war against Turkey, just like the you know, ETA, the in Spain, you know, There are ethnic groups. Well, it's sort of like the Protestants in largely Catholic Ireland, you know, saying, you know, hey, wait a minute, we're different than those guys over there. And so, you know, we say, well, we're stuck in the middle of this civil war, this ethnic battle, and we are. And it's a religious war between the Shia and the Sunni. And then you get into the even the larger issues of ethnicity, you know, with the Kurds, and the Kurds are trying to stay out of the way, I think. They're saying, okay, just give us our own country in the north, and we'll be fine. Give us a little bit of oil, we'll be fine. And they're actually, I think, the most stable of the bunch right now. But time will tell. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be that the Reverend Moon is at some level, to some degree, running the United States? Steve Hassan is with us. He's with freedomofmind.com is his website. He's a licensed mental health counselor, a former member of the Moonies. Steve Hassan. Is that the correct pronunciation, Steve?
Hassan, yes.
Hassan, thank you very much. You were inside the Moon Organization. This is an organization that owns the Washington Times, the newspaper that Ronald Reagan proudly proclaimed was the only paper he would read, that George W. Bush has proudly proclaimed it's the only newspaper he will read. It loses $2 million a month and certainly does a great job of getting, you know, good old Tony, its spokesman out there everywhere. What's the deal here with the Reverend Moon?
Oh, well, I should say Bush Sr. recently spoke at the 25th anniversary of the Washington Times. My understanding and my tracking of this group goes back to the 70s. There was a KoreaGate investigation that was looking into Korean CIA activities in the United States, and at the time George Bush Sr. was head of the CIA. And in 1977 and 1978, there was a large investigation into this, including defectors from the KCIA and the South Korean government, that talked about plans for covert manipulation of the U.S. and its government, and one of the elements was Moon. And
wait a minute. So you're saying that the Reverend Moon is representing the interests of South Korea, or does he control the interests of South Korea? I mean, which is the dog and which is the tail here?
My understanding is that he's more a tool of intelligence than he's running things. He certainly appears to have billions of dollars. He's certainly involved in the media, as you mentioned, the Washington Times and UPI. And on my website, I have a list of some 50 pages, single-spaced, of groups and businesses that he runs around the world. And he's got a very large percentage of the fishing industry, I should say, of the United States as well. And back when I was a Moonie, which was 2 years in the mid-70s, Moon actually said, when the global economy falls apart, we'll have the infrastructure in place to take over the world. And as a Moonie, we thought that Moon was the Messiah, that he was 10 times greater than Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad. We believed that democracy was evil, that a theocracy should be put into place to run the world. And in fact, during one leadership meeting, Moon was talking to myself and a number of other people and saying that when we took over the world, we should decide which countries we wanted to run. So, but whether or not Moon actually has that power to run the world or is running the U.S. government, I kind of doubt it at this point, looking at this group for so many years. But I definitely think he's a dangerous person, and he's certainly not a friend of anyone who cares about civil liberties or freedom of mind, and certainly not democracy.
We're talking to Stephen Alan Hassan. He is a certified cult counselor, mind control expert. His website, freedomofmind.com, on the inside with the Moonies and the Moon organization, this extraordinary thing. You know, I think a lot of Americans, when they think of Moonies, remember 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when the Moonies were, you know, the people on the corner selling the flowers, or the people sitting in phone, you know, in wheelchairs as if they were disabled, and outside of supermarkets asking for donations. Very often young people sitting, you know, I remember in a number of cities coming across people who were in wheelchairs, and yet there was nothing wrong with them. You know, it was just, you know, part of the begging routine.
Yeah, that's true.
Those.
And I actually sold flowers, and I was head of a fundraising team. In fact, I fell asleep at the wheel of a van due to sleep exhaustion, which led to my rescue from by my family out of the group.
Interesting. Now, we just don't see that face of the Moon organization in the United States anymore. How extensive is the cult end of the Moon organization? I mean, you've documented the extraordinary extent of his business operations and his media. He owns United Press International. He owns the Washington Times. He owns much of the U.S. fishing industry. All these, you know, hundreds of other companies. But what about the cult leader?
I should also add he has a gun factory in Worcester, Massachusetts, so that car arms. And essentially, this organization is an authoritarian pyramid structured group that is run exclusively by the Koreans, in my opinion. They have Japanese leaders and they have Caucasian American leaders, but they're kind of puppets. They've really shifted their operation from being on the streets and in universities to what they do these days is they contact politicians, religious leaders, media personalities, and say they want to give them an award and they should come to some four-star hotel, and other famous people of their community will be receiving awards too. And they schmooze them and give them a free dinner and want to get their pictures taken with them in order to try to normalize, you know, the organization. And so they're more interested in recruiting power dealers than they're interested in recruiting college students.
Well, they actually got John Warner to reserve a room in the United States Capitol building where a member of the House of Representatives, a member of Congress, brought a crown to Reverend Moon and crowned him the new Messiah, the King of the World.
Yes, that actually happened in our Senate office buildings. And I should also mention that there have been numerous full-page ads taken in major newspapers around the country where they talk about how a dead Moonie leader has been converting people like Confucius and Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and even Hitler in the spirit world. So they're all followers now of Moon. And, you know, it's so ludicrous and so absurd.
What about some of their front people? Like Tony Blankley, for example. He works for the Washington Times. He's on the McLaughlin Group every week. He's all over the media. Is this guy a Moonie? Is he just a conservative who happens to have a good job with an organization that's willing to lose money to pay him? Or?
I think that's more the case. I would doubt that he bows to an altar with Moon's picture on it and recites a pledge, as I did, to fight with his life and defend the homeland, Korea. I think that he's probably getting very handsomely paid, and he's probably been rationalizing that the conservatives need a voice, and therefore, you know, it's okay for him to take Moon's money and help to give him legitimacy.
Jerry Falwell and the Bush family have both been major recipients of the largesse of this new Messiah, this guy who has replaced Jesus, Reverend Moon, who owns the Washington Times. Is that an accurate statement?
That's true. Millions of dollars have apparently flowed to both of these individuals. By the way, I wanted to mention that a talk has been put on video.google.com about that included the founding editor, James Whalen of the Washington Times, and then editorial page editor James Cheshire, speaking about their departure from the Washington Times, talking about how the Moonies were controlling content, which, of course, the Moonies, when they left, said that it had nothing to do with it and it was just a monetary dispute, but that's not the case, and people can see for themselves or hear for themselves.
So we just have about a half a minute left. We're talking with Steve Hassan, freedomofmind.com. Is Reverend Moon controlling or influencing policy in the United States, or is he simply exploiting conservative, you know, useful idiots?
I think he's probably been influencing policy. I think that he's been influencing a lot of especially foreign affairs issues with Korea and other countries. And I definitely think that people should come on my website and start reading some of the literature that's up. I have some of the congressional investigation on my website, their final conclusions and recommendations. They basically said this group needs to be investigated and put out of business.
Interesting. And the website is Freedom of Mind. Yeah, the website is freedomofmind.com. Steve Hassan. Steve, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. Well, actually, a little scary talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
And all the more of the tragedy for America, Americans, Iraq, Iraqis, and the rest of the planet. 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott with us, the founder and editor at VAWatchdog.org, one of the best websites for veterans to get the inside scoop on what's going on in veterans affairs. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
You are over at VAWatchdog.org taking on Senator Larry Craig.
On Senator Larry Craig a lot. Larry Craig is a Republican senator from the state of Idaho, used to be the chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, now finds himself as the ranking member or ranking minority member. He is opposed to mandatory funding for VA health care. Right now, VA health care is funded as part of the discretionary budget. It's argued over every year. A little gets cut here, a little gets added there. There are a lot of good arguments for putting this in the mandatory budget. Craig says no. We don't want to spend the money. And he uses the old, old baloney excuses that VA spending is like Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security. It is so big, it's just going to eat up the entire budget. Well, as we know, they're not anything like that. Medicaid is a program to help those who are in need. Medicare and Social Security are insurance programs. But he continues to make this comparison. And the most brutal thing he does, and shows incredible disrespect for our veterans and their families, he talks about putting a cap on the federal budget, and we have to cap our spending. But what Craig never mentions, Tom, is that there is no cap on war spending, and there most assuredly is no cap on the number of troops who are coming home wounded and injured from these wars. We can't put a cap on the number of people who are hurt. How in the name of whomever can we put a cap on the spending at the VA? But that's what he wants to do.
This is obscene.
It is obscene. It is absolutely obscene.
But Larry, you have to keep in mind, and you know, Senator Larry Craig, and like the vast majority of the Republican Party, is representing his constituency, which is, you know, a couple hundred thousand millionaire, actually a couple tens of thousands, millionaires and billionaires in the United States. And they do not want to see their taxes go back up to where they were under Bill Clinton, or, God forbid, where they were under Jack Kennedy.
And that's exactly right. And the Democrats, too, Tom, we're having a problem with the T word here. You just said it. Taxes. We know we cannot continue on the spending course that we have in this country without increasing taxes. Craig totally ignores that. Craig belongs to this group of people of what I call finite funders. There's only so much money. Why? Because we say there's only so much money. Well, you and I know that's not true. I would rather tax and spend than borrow and spend like we're doing now. But Craig doesn't see that. He wants to put a cap on everything.
Right, and let our grandchildren pay for it.
Right. Oh, if I could bring up something else real quickly.
Sure, go for it.
The Dole Shalala Commission, former Senator Bob Dole, former Human or Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, the commission, presidentially appointed, nine-member commission, presented their report to President Bush this morning at the White House. They're just about to go public with the report. We don't quite know what's in it yet, but it looks like they're calling for a complete overhaul of the VA and military health care systems, more benefits for families, better care for PTSD patients. What we do know from a report that came out of the White House this morning is they presented the report to the president earlier this morning before they're going to make it public. The president called it interesting, but said not to expect any action right away.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what that means. Bob Woodruff of ABC News, you know, who had been wounded in Iraq, was there at that meeting. And Woodruff asked the president whether or not the government was moving fast enough to help the families of the wounded and veterans. President refused to answer the question.
Amazing.
Exactly.
Well, you know, he really loves the troops when he can use them as props for a photo. But beyond that,
right.
You know.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, in the meantime, Jim Nicholson, Secretary Nicholson, outgoing Secretary Nicholson, is being sued?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, it's a suit against the Secretary of the VA. So when Nicholson leaves, this proposed class action lawsuit will just transfer to whomever. A couple of small veterans groups, one with about 11,000 members, another with about 500 members, joined together with a legal firm in California, and they've filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of all Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, especially those who have had problems with mental health issues or PTSD. What they want is they want relief from the VA. They're not looking for money here. They're looking for relief, better care, more people to care for mental health issues. And also, they want the court to look at the Pentagon and the VA, who they feel are getting troops discharged who have mental health issues. This is what we call the personality disorder discharge, where they say, "Oh no, you've got a mental health problem. You brought it with you. Get out of the military. No benefits."
It's like the military version of pre-existing conditions.
Yeah,
with,
right.
Private health insurance.
That's what they're calling it. The lawsuit is rather interesting. The attorneys I've talked to who practice veterans law have a feeling the court may not give a class action status, but we'll keep an eye on it because it could rearrange the way the VA does business, Tom.
Yeah, definitely. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to, and you're doing a great job, Larry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, our website. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
You know, George Bernard Shaw said, "When I die, I want to be thoroughly used up." Right there. Oh, we've all got to say, you know, we're not going to give up this country easily. It's it has been a bastion of liberal and progressive thought since its creation. It was created by the children of the Enlightenment, the people like George Washington, who proudly called himself a liberal and still is. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, representing the 8th District of San Francisco, California, on the floor of the House of Representatives today, talking about how an extraordinary piece of legislation was just passed.
Minority in support of this legislation. Yes, I have had the privilege of working with Mr. Rohrabacher, with the ranking member Ross Layton, and others, and Mr. Wolf and Mr. Smith all over the years on issues that relate to human rights throughout the world, and I respect them for their leadership in so many arenas. And
she's speaking well of these Republicans because so many of them voted for this. And it is a bill that states it is the policy of the United States not to establish any military installation or base for the purpose of providing a permanent stationing of United States armed forces in Iraq.
It's been a privilege to work with them. I'm so glad they're supporting this legislation today. Mr. Speaker, I think it's very important for us to measure any initiative in relationship to the war in Iraq against the backdrop of what does this do to contribute to a vision for stability in the Middle East. Whether we're talking about no permanent bases, whether we're talking about redeploying our troops out of Iraq, a change of mission there to lead troops only for specific limited purposes. This is what the generals have told us. General Odom, for one, has said any vision for stability in the Middle East must begin with the redeployment of troops out of Iraq. So too this issue today, no permanent bases. Yes, our colleagues are correct that this has been brought before the Congress before and has been passed into law. But the fact is that it may not have been heard adequately by the administration and certainly not by the people in the region. This legislation clearly signals that the United States does not seek a permanent military presence in Iraq.
Good on you, Nancy Pelosi, and Democrats, and the Republicans who voted for this thing. So this is out of the House. We'll see what the Senate does and then what Bush does. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Oh, but before I get to that, our resident genius sent me a note here. This is from the Wikipedia, of course, and actually the folks in our chat room you can get to over at airamerica.com or tomhartman.com also pointed out the Wikipedia entry about the Kurds, because the question are the Kurds Shia or Sunni? In addition to Kurds, who comprise the majority of the region, Kurdistan, there are also communities of Arab, Armenian, Assyrian, Azeri, Jewish, Ossetian, Persian, and Turkic people. But the bottom line today, the majority of Kurds are officially Muslim, belonging to the Shafi school of Sunni Islam. Mystical practices and participation in Sufi orders is also widespread among the Kurds. And there are also a minority of Kurds who are Shia Muslims, living primarily in Ilam and Karmanishan provinces of Iran and central Iraq, the Fayali Kurds. And then it's been said that Kurds hold their Islam lightly, meaning that their faiths tend not to be as assertive as it can become in other areas. They tend not to be fundamentalists. Morton in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Morton, what's on your mind today?
I wondered if you would please repeat what you had reported about a Dr. Biggs who was appointed by President Bush under a recess to be a number two man in the Social Security
Administration, right. This is a guy who has written extensively about how he believes that the Social Security program, a federal insurance program which covers injured people, disabled people, literally widows and orphans, and retired people, elderly people. It's an insurance program. A third of all the benefits from the Social Security insurance program go to not to retired people, but go to people like my friend Michael Hutchison in Santa Fe, for example, who fell off a bridge and broke his neck, and he's paralyzed from the neck down. That's a third of all the Social Security recipients in the United States. It is the ultimate social safety net, and he has said many times on the record in writing that he believes that Social Security should be handed over to big private corporations, and he hasn't said you know, to hell with everybody else. But that's the inference that I think that we can all reasonably draw from it. So anyhow, well, that's who he is, and that's what he's all about. And he's now the number two guy in the Social Security Administration.
Yes, but the frightening thing is that the approval committee from the Senate for that appointment wouldn't even listen to his confirmation because of his past views. And so President Bush made the appointment during recess when he can't be confirmed.
That's right. The Senate refused.
Well, my question is, why hasn't one thing been said either on TV or in the newspapers about this? I mean,
that's a good question. Probably because it is this whole issue of privatizing Social Security is something that, by and large, the large mainstream corporate media in the United States is in favor of, because most of them are these giant transnational corporations that have interlocking boards with the insurance companies and banking industry that will make a fortune off the corporatization. We shouldn't even call it privatization. Call it corporatization of Social Security. I mean, there's big money to be made. When they did it down in Peru, when they did it down in Argentina, it wiped out the Social Security funds, but the bankers and the insurance companies made an absolute screaming fortune, and that's what these guys are salivating about. So that, in my opinion, Morton, that's why you're not hearing about it. But, you know, I could be wrong. Call me a conspiracy theorist. Jason in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Jason.
Hello, Tom. Nice to talk to you. My question was, all these corporations are losing, you know, money left and right. Ford, General Motors, the large corporations, they blame it on health care paying out to the unions and their employees. To me, it would make much sense to go ahead and have some type of national health care program to help them out. And if they wanted to go ahead and carry insurance, do a supplemental insurance to them, like an Aflac, on top of, you know, the national health care.
There actually is a growing segment of the American business community, including the American big business community, that is in favor of a single-payer national health care system.
Right.
And it's just that they're not much reported on. But, yeah, absolutely. It would be in their interest. I mean, Toyota was, and again, you know, I'm not a big fan of foreign companies coming over here and building factories. I think we should be doing it ourselves. But Toyota was, I believe it was Toyota, was building a factory, was going to build a factory in North America. And Alabama thought they had the deal. There were a bunch of states that were competing. Who's going to give the biggest tax breaks? Who's going to give more land, you know, for free, blah, 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 blah. And ultimately, even though they were offered millions, perhaps tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in freebies and tax breaks and this, that, and the other thing, they went to Canada instead. And why? Because they didn't want to have to pay for the cost of health insurance. And in Canada, it's, you know, it's just kind of spread all across the entire economy rather than concentrated among the employers and the employees. And it is a real drain on our economy, Jason. Spot on. It really is a drain on our economy. Tim in Tennessee. Hey, Tim.
Hello, Tom. Glad to talk to you. I've got so many things I'd like to talk to you about. Is there any way I can get you to come to my house for dinner some night?
Thanks for the offer, Tim.
I'm in these same groups that we talked about today. I'm on disability myself. I've been since 96. Here in Tennessee, I feel like I'm being doubly screwed in reference to your book, Screwed, which I love. The tax system here in the state is all sales tax. There's no income tax. There's approximately 10% sales tax on everything, including food and groceries. Now, we got a gigantic break here the 1st of July. They reduced the tax on food by one-half of 1%. How lucky I am. But anyways, I don't understand it here. I mean, you say the word tax in Tennessee, and people fall apart like a cheap suit, especially the upper-income people. A few years ago, they wanted to put an income tax system in, and you would have thought it was the end of the world.
Well, this is the thing, the Grover Norquists of the world, and, you know, this all began with Reagan in, you know, writ large. I mean, they were always the lunatic fringe before Reagan, but it became the mainstream with Reagan, have done a very, very good job of convincing the media that even in the face of polls that show that, you know, 68% of Americans are willing to pay more taxes if it means that the infrastructure of the United States is rebuilt or if it means that we have national health care.
Yes.
You know, the vast majority of Americans. But they have got the media convinced that people are terrified of taxes.
Yeah, they just had to do away with a very good health program here. It was called TennCare, where a lot of the poor people were covered by health insurance. And they figured that's what was causing the budget deficit, so they had to do away with it instead of increasing taxes. And people like me and low-income people are paying a bigger share of their income in taxes in this state than the richer people.
Yep, but the billionaires and millionaires, the Fred Thompsons of Tennessee, they're doing very well. The Bill Frists, they're doing very well. Thank you very much. Good point, Tim. Thanks a lot for the call. From Tim to Tim in Denver. Hey, Tim, we got about a minute before the break. What's up?
Tom, Tom, thank you very much for taking my call. Tom, I just wanted to talk about the stuff that we were talking about earlier, the situation in Iraq. And I think the Democratic candidates are really missing the target, and they're playing right into the hand of Republicans. The situation in Iraq is because of the Iran's influence. Iran has solid interest to keep Iraq in a stable and chaotic. And the only way to stop this situation is to stop Iran's influence into Iraq. And that's what Democrats have to propose, that by pulling the troops out of Iraq, we must...
So, Tim, just a real quick question, Tim. If that's the case, why is it that the majority of the people who are foreign fighters in Iraq that we've arrested are from Saudi Arabia, not from Iran?
But it doesn't matter. They don't have to be from Iran. But Iran is the one who provides them with weapons, with support, with logistics, with training, with all
of that. So the Sunni fighters who constitute the majority of the insurgency?
Exactly. Iran.
But the Iranians are Shia.
But Iran has interest in keeping Iraq in a stable and chaotic. That's the only way that they can force U.S. forces to be out of Iraq.
Respectfully, Tim, I disagree with you. I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that Iran has an interest in Iraq being stable and a stable neighbor on their frontier. I mean, well, they did fight a war with them, but that was Saddam Hussein. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Save us from the lies. Save our homes from foreclosing. Stop treating us as spies. Save our jobs from leaving. Bring back made in USA. Represent the ones who made you, not the ones who paved your way.
So I get this note from David Kubiak, old friend of mine who's very, very involved in the 9/11 truth movement and a whole bunch of other things, very involved in the corporate personhood movement as well. And David points out the story that we reported a week or so ago about the Samoan butterflies that are literally going through major evolutionary changes in two or three generations. It's because of a parasite that has appeared on the South Pacific Ocean that is attacking their eggs. And they literally, I mean, we're watching evolution happen. And he points out, in the case of H. bullina, we're witnessing an evolutionary arms race between the parasite and the host. This strengthens the view that parasites can be major drivers in evolution. This is from the scientific study. And David says, this could be the Bush-Cheney corporate coup's greatest legacy. Read all about it. Corporate parasites trigger evolutionary leap and rebirth of populist democracy. Could be. Could be. Could be that the strangeness of the Bush-Cheney administration and all the corporatists is the catalyst for a new democratic United States, small-D democratic, just like the Great Depression was for Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, or the Panic of 1893 was for Teddy Roosevelt and the Square Deal. Who knows? I don't know. We'll see as time goes on. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number, Timothy in Memphis, Tennessee, WSMB. Hey, Timothy.
Yeah, good. But, Tom, I wanted to reinforce with you the achievement of Speaker Pelosi in terms of this advance in understanding and letting the Middle East, the Arab world, understand that it is not our intention to locate permanent bases for influence and control in a fascist manner over the Arab peoples, because they've been going through this. I'm sure you're aware of the First World War and after that, and what we did with the Arabs of the Western powers. So the point is that I want to contrast this with what Cindy Sheehan seems to be indicating in terms of wanting to run for Congress. I think it's more of an emotional, reactive kind of motivation, because I think in her case, she was in Conyers' office, as you know, with some other people being arrested. But anyway, she would be departing from her greatest strength and the most cogent voice for on behalf of Americans suffering from the death.
No, I don't disagree with you, Timothy, and I'm very ambivalent about Cindy Sheehan saying that she's going to run against Nancy Pelosi. But that's a longer discussion for another time. But forward motion, and I think that they need to take the next step. Nancy Pelosi said no permanent bases. Now they need to say also the oil deal that we've been talking about, we want you guys to have with these production sharing agreements. We're taking that off the table, too. You guys can do whatever you want with your oil. It's your country. And at that point, I think the Iraqis will say, oh, okay, we'll stop shooting at you. Just get out. Zafara in Seattle. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yes, you are. Thank you, Tom. I just have so many questions. I'd just better give a couple of comments and questions, and maybe you could answer it off the air. With Jim McDermott, he kind of gives me a ray of hope. He was just very outstanding, and I think right on with his how he feels about this whole situation. And with the oil interests and this other gentleman, with the oil interests, the administration keeps doing whatever it wants to do, no matter what. I mean, I suspect, even with today's news with Nancy Pelosi and what they passed, and our decider / wannabe dictator is just going to do whatever he has. So my question here is, how in the world can we kind of put a stop to this administration before our rule of law and our Constitution is, decimated?
Well, that's our rule of law important. And our Constitution have already been shredded to a large extent,
yes, they have.
And we need to be stepping out and saying, no, enough to that. That's it. No more. You can't go any further. And frankly, in my opinion, that means bringing forward articles of impeachment, or at the very least, what Russ Feingold is calling for. I mean, this is a very soft step, is to have a censure motion. Say enough. We're slapping your hands. We're acknowledging or we're pointing out that the Bush administration has committed crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors. But, I don't see that happening. And I don't see it happening, frankly, because Congress isn't convinced that you and I want that. And it's not going to be until our elected members of Congress, our elected representatives, hear from enough of us that they get it, that this is a big deal. This is a huge, big deal. Scott in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It was kind of disturbing to hear Pelosi actually backing the oil agreements, but this could be where she's coming from, and maybe you can enlighten me on it. What if that oil, if it doesn't, go to the Exxons and BP, gets in the hands of the terrorists instead?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, define the terrorists.
Al Qaeda, all that in Iraq,
Yeah.
The people that are there that are trying to, or the insurgents.
Your question assumes that there's a group of people over there who really just want to get us because they don't like us, and it's just it's a very simplistic worldview. There's not a group of people out there who want to get us because they don't like us. There's a group of people. There's a whole bunch of different groups of people out there who want to get us because they don't like our behavior, and. That's where we begin, is with our behavior. And frankly, getting out of Iraq is one of the things that will reduce violence and will reduce terrorism around the world. And the Iraqi people are not terrorists. There had never been a suicide bombing in the country of Iraq in its 7,000-year history until we showed up in town. Never. Incredible. Coming up tomorrow, Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, Matt Stoller and Nancy Scola from OpenLeft.com and AirAmerica.com. Your calls, the news of the day. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at AirAmericaRadio.com.